Greetings, everyone. We are still deep in the story of the fisherman. After how many nights is it? The story of the fisherman started on the third night, and tonight is the seventh night, and still going on strongly.
Let's see how it goes then.
When it was the seventh night, she continued, "It hath reached me, O auspicious king, that when the fishes spoke, and the young lady upset the frying pan with the rod, and went forth by the way she came, and the wall closed up, the vizier cried out, 'This is a thing not to be hidden from the king.' So he went and told him what happened, whereupon king said, 'There is no help for it, but that I see this with mine own eyes.' What are you, a child? Just believe him." Then he sent for the fisherman and commanded him to bring four other fish, like the first, and to take with him three men as witnesses. The fisherman at once brought the fish, and the king, after ordering them to give him 400 gold pieces, turned to the vizier and said, "Up and fry me the fishes here before me." The minister replying, "To hear is to obey," bade bring the frying pan, threw therein the cleansed fish, and set it over the fire, when lo, the wall clave asunder, and out burst a black slave like a huge rock, or a remnant of a tribe, bearing in hand a branch of a green tree, and he cried in loud and terrible tones, O fish, be ye all constant to your antique covenant?" Whereupon the fish lifted their heads from the frying pan and said, "Yes, yes, we be true to our vow." And they again recited these couplets, "Come back, and so will I, keep faith, and so will I, but if ye fain forsake, I'll requite till quits we cry." Then the huge blackamoor approached the frying pan and upset it with the branch, and went forth by the way he came in. When he vanished from their sight, the king inspected the fish, and finding them all charred black as charcoal, was utterly bewildered, and said to the vizier, "Verily, this is a matter wherein in silence cannot be kept. And as for the fishes, assuredly some marvellous adventure connects with them." So he bade bring the fisherman, and asked him, "Fie on thee, fella, whence came these fishes?" "From a tarn between four heights lying behind these mountains, which is in sight of thy city." "How many days march?" "Oh, our lord the sultan, a walk of half hour." The king wondered, and straightway ordering his men to march and horsemen to mount, led off the fisherman, who went before as a guide, privily damning the ifrit. They fared on till they had climbed the mountain and descended unto a great desert, which they had never seen during all their lives. And the sultan and his merry men marvelled much at the world set in the midst of four mountains, and the tarn and its fishes of four colours, red, white, yellow, and blue. The king stood fixed to the spot in wonderment, and asked his troops and all present, "Hath any one among you ever seen this piece of water before now?" And all made answer, "O king of the age, never did we set eyes upon it during all our days." They also questioned the oldest inhabitants they met, men well stricken in years, but they replied, each and every, "A lakelet like this we never saw in this place." Thereupon quoth the king, "By Allah, I will neither return to my capital, nor sit upon the throne of my forebears, till I learn the truth about this tarn and the fish therein." He then ordered his men to dismount and bivouac all around the mountain, which they did, and summoning his vizier, a minister of much experience, sagacious, of penetrating wit, and well-versed in affairs, said to him, "'Tis in my mind to do a certain thing, whereof I will inform thee. My heart telleth me to fare forth alone this night, and root out the mystery of this tarn and its fishes. Do thou take thy seat at my tent door, and say to the emirs and viziers and the chamberlains, in fine to all who ask thee, the sultan is ill at ease, and he hath ordered me to refuse all admittance, and be careful thou let none know my design, and the vizier could not oppose him. Then the king changed his dress and ornaments, and slinging his sword over his shoulder, took a path which led up one of the mountains, and marched for the rest of the night, till morning dawned. Nor did he cease wayfaring till the heat was too much for him. After his long walk he rested for a while, and then resumed his march, and fared on through the second night till dawn, when suddenly there appeared a black point in the far distance. Hereat he rejoiced and said to himself, "Haply, someone there shall acquaint me with the mystery of the tarn and his fishes." Presently, drawing near the dark object, he found it a palace built of swart stone plated with iron, and while one leaf of the gate stood wide open, the other one was shut. The king's spirits rose high as he stood before the gate and rapped, a light rap. But hearing no answer, he knocked. He knocked a second knock, and a third. Yet there came no sign. Then he knocked his loudest, but still no answer. So he said, "Doubtless 'tis empty." Thereupon he mustered up resolution and boldly walked through the main gate into the great hall, and there cried out loud,
"Hola, ye people of the palace! I am a stranger and a wayfarer. Have you aught here of victual?"
He repeated his cry a second time and a third, but still there came no reply. So strengthening his heart and walking up, and making up his mind, he stalked through the vestibule into the very middle of the palace, and found no man in it. Yet it was furnished with silken stuffs, gold starred, and the hangings were let down over the doorways. In the midst was a spacious court, of which sat four open saloons, each with its raised dais, saloon facing saloon. A canopy shaded the court, and in the center was a jetting fount with four figures of lions made of red gold, spouting from their mouths water clear as pearl and diaphanous gem. What is a diaphanous gem?
I don't know. It's a weird palace anyway.
Round about the palace birds were let loose, and over it stretched a net of golden wire, hindering them from flying off. In brief, there was everything but human beings. The king marveled mightily thereat, yet felt he sad at heart, for that he saw no one to give him account of the waste and its tarn, the fishes, the mountains, and the palace itself. Presently, as he sat between the doors, deep thought, behold, there came a voice of lament, a form as from heart grief spent. He heard the voice chanting these verses: "I hid what I endured of him, and yet it came to light. And nightly sleep mine eyelids fled, and changed to sleepless night. O world, O fate, withhold thy hand, and cease thy hurt and harm. Look, and behold my hapless sprit, in colour and affright. Wilt ne'er show ruth to high-born youth, who lost him on the way of love, and fell from wealth and fame to lowest, basest wight. Jealous of Zephyr's breath was I, as on your form he breathed, but when as destiny descends, she blindeth human sight. What shall the hapless archer do, who when he fronts his foe, and bends his bow to shoot the shaft, shall find his string undight, when cark and care so heavy bear on youth of generous soul? How shall he escape his lot, and where from fate his place of flight?" Now when the Sultan heard the mournful voice, he sprang to his feet, and following the sound found a certain letdown over a chamber door. He raised it, and saw behind it a young man sitting upon a couch about a cubit above the ground, and be fair to the sight, a well-shaped wight with eloquence dight. His forehead was flower white, his cheek rosy bright, and a mole on his cheek breadth like an ambergris might. Even as the poet says, "A youth slim waisted, from whose locks and brow the world in blackness and in light is set. Throughout creations round no fairer show, no rarer sight thine eye hath ever met. A nut-brown mole sit throned upon a cheek of rosiest red beneath an eye of jet. The king rejoiced and saluted him, but he remained sitting in his kaftan of silken stuff purfled with Egyptian gold, and his crown studded with gems of sorts. But his face was sad, when the traces of sorrow. You don't see it so often in literature, not even in this book. Such words of admiration for the beauty of a young man. There's always, as there is no shortage of admiration words for beauty of ladies. This is a curious case. The king rejoiced and saluted him, but he remained sitting in his kaftan of silken stuff, purfled with Egyptian gold, and his crown studded with gems of sorts. But his face was sad, with the traces of sorrow. He returned the royal salute in most courteous wise, adding, O my lord, thy dignity demandeth me rising to thee, and my sole excuse is to crave thy pardon, quoth the king. Thou art excused, O youth, so look upon me as thy guest. Come hither on an especial object. I would thou acquaint me with the secrets of this tarn and its fishes, and of this palace and thy loneliness therein, and the case and the cause of thy groaning and wailing. When the young man heard these words, he wept with sore weeping. Here in the footnotes it says, this readiness of shedding tears contrasts strongly with the external stoicism of modern civilization, but it is true to Arab character, and Easterners, like the heroes of Homer, are not ashamed of what we look upon as the result of feminine hysteria, a good cry. While it is a good point, that word Arab annoys me to see it everywhere. Even when people translated this book into English or French, they translated the title into Arabian Nights, which is not quite true. Although the text was in Arabic and you can see traces of Arabic culture of that time in it, but if you dig a little bit deeper, you'd see traces of all of the cultures of the Middle East, like from India to Iran to Afghanistan, and even from the time that the so-called Arab countries were not Arabs, like Egypt or Iraq or Syria. These countries, before Arabs came, they were not Arabs. I guess what I'm saying is, Westerners did what Westerners do. Generalization and reducing a whole complex network of cultures to just one word, Arab. Well, I'd say from now on, whenever you hear the word Arab in this series, just imagine all of the cultures of the Middle East from, I don't know, from Egypt to India to Afghanistan to Armenia and Azerbaijan. These are all interconnected, and these stories especially, this book is a kind of a collection of folk stories of all of these cultures gathered around under an overarching story of a Persian emperor and Shahrzad and Dunyazad. So all I'm saying is just try to keep an open mind and let's move forward. When the young man heard these words, he wept with sore weeping till his bosom was drenched with tears and began reciting, say him who careless sleeps that while the shaft of fortune flies, how many cloth this shifting world lay low and raised to rise. Although thine eye be sealed in sleep, sleep not the Almighty's eyes, and who hath found time of affair or fate in constant guise? Then he sighed a long-fetched sigh and recited, confide thy case to him, the Lord who made mankind, quit cark and care and cultivate content of mind. Ask not the past, or how, or why it came to pass. All human things by fate and destiny were designed. The king marveled and asked him, what maketh thee weep, O young man? How should I not weep when this is my case? Thereupon he put out his hand and raised the skirt of his garment, when lo, the lower half of him appeared stone down to his feet, while from his navel to the hair of his head he was a man. The king, seeing this his plight,
grieved with sore grief, and of his compassion cried, "Alack, and well away, in very sooth, O youth, thou heapest sorrow upon my sorrow. I was minded to ask thee the mystery of fishes only, whereas now I am concerned to learn thy story as well as theirs. But there is no majesty and there is no might save in Allah, the glorious, the great."
Interesting. So this sentence that we see all around these stories, this was, "There is no majesty and there is no might save in Allah, the glorious, the great." This is a rough translation of La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah, which is in Arabic and says words, but it's like a saying in Arabic, and also in Persian people say that too. When they face a curious situation, they want to express a certain feeling and put the weight on someone else's shoulder. I don't know how to explain this. Anyway, after he says that, he says, "Lose no time, O youth, but tell me forthright thy whole tale." He says, "Lend me thine ears, thy sight, and thine insight. All are at thy service. Right wondrous and marvelous is my case, and that of these fishes, and were it graven with gravers upon the eye corners, it were a warner to whoso would be warned." "How is that?" asked the king, and the young man began to tell the tale of the ensorcelled prince. "Know then, O my lord, that whilom my sire was king of this city, and his name was Mahmud, entitled Lord of the Black Islands, and owner of what are now these four mountains. He ruled 70 years, after which he went to the mercy of the Lord, and I reigned as sultan in his stead. I took to wife my cousin, the daughter of my paternal uncle, and she loved me with such abounding love that whenever I was absent, she ate not and she drank not until she saw me again." Another curious thing that I see a lot in these stories, and also I saw a lot in Iran, is that people marry their cousins, and it's not even frowned upon, let alone called incest, like the Americans do. It's astonishing how these often strong moral beliefs are 100% rooted in culture. "She cohabited with me for 5 years, till a certain day when she went forth to the hammam bath, and I bade the cook hasten to get ready all the requisites for our supper. And I entered this palace and lay down on the bed where I was wont to sleep, and bade two damsels to fan my face, one sitting by my head and the other at my feet. But I was troubled and made restless for my wife's absence, and could not sleep. For although my eyes were closed, my mind and thoughts were wide awake. Presently I heard the slave girl at my head say to the other, 'Oh, Masuda, how miserable is our master, and how wasted in his youth. And oh, the pity of his being so betrayed by our mistress.' 'The accursed whore,' the other replied. 'Yes, indeed. Allah curse all faithless women and the adulteress. But the like of our master, with his fair gifts, deserveth something better than this harlot who lieth abroad every night.' 'Then,' quoth she who sat by my head, 'is our lord dumb, or fit only for bubbling that he questioneth her not?' And quoth the other, 'Fie on thee! Doth our lord know her ways, or doth she allow him his choice? Nay, more, doth he not drug every night the cup she giveth him to drink before sleep time, and put bang into it? So he sleepeth and wotteth not whither she goeth, nor what she doeth. But we know that after giving him the drugged wine, she donneth her richest raiment and perfumeth herself, and then she fareth out from him to be away till break of day. Then she cometh to him and burneth a pastile under his nose, and he awaketh from his death-like sleep. When I heard the slave girl's words, the light became black before my sight, and I thought night would never fall. Presently the daughter of my uncle came from the baths, and they
set the table for us, and we ate and sat together a fair half hour, quaffing our wine, as was ever our wont. Then she called for the particular wine I used to drink before sleeping, and reached me the cup. But seeming to drink it according to my wont, I poured the contents into my bosom, and lying down, let her hear that I was asleep. Then behold, she cried, "Sleep out the night, and never wake again. By Allah, I loathe thee, and I loathe thy whole body, and my soul turneth in disgust from cohabiting with thee, and I see not the moment when Allah shall snatch away thy life." Then she rose and donned her fairest dress, and perfumed her person, and slung my sword over her shoulder, and opening the gates of the palace, went her ill way. I rose and followed her as she left the palace, and she threaded the streets until she came to the city gate, where she spoke words I understood not, and the padlocks dropped of themselves as if broken, and the gate leaves open. She went forth, and I after her, without her noticing aught, till she came at last to the outlying mounds, and a reed fence, built about a round-roofed hut of mud bricks. As she entered the door, I climbed upon the roof, which commanded a view of the interior, and lo, my fair cousin had gone in to a hideous negro slave, with his upper lip like the cover of a pot. Fuck, you are racist. And his lower like an open pot, lips which might sweep up sand from the gravel floor of the cot. Holy shit. He was to boot a leper and a paralytic, lying upon a strew of sugarcane trash, and wrapped in an old blanket, and the foulest rags and tatters. She kissed the earth before him, and he raised his head so as to see her, and said, "Woe to thee! What call hadst thou to stay away all this time? Here have been with me sundry of the black brethren, who drank their wine, and each had his young lady, and I was not content to drink because of thine absence." Then she, "O my lord, my heart's love and cooleth of my eyes. Knowest thou not that I am married to my cousin, whose very look I loathe, and hate myself when in his company? And did not I fear for thy sake, I would not let a single sun arise before making his city a ruined heap, wherein raven should croak and howlet hoot, and jackal and wolf harbour and loot. Nay, I had removed its very stones to the backside of Mount Kaf," rejoined the slave. "Thou liest, damn thee! Now I swear an oath by the valour and honour of blackamoor men, and deem not our manliness to be the poor manliness of white men." Now he is throwing shades on white people. Race is a joke to these people. It's awesome. "From today forth, if thou stay away till this hour, I will not keep company with thee, nor will I glue my body with thy body and strum and belly bump." I assume he's talking about sex by belly bump. Belly bump. It's a cute way of saying. "Doest play fast and loose with us, thou cracked pot, that we may satisfy thy dirty lusts, stinkered bitch, vilest of the vile whites." When I heard his word, and saw with my own eyes what passed between these two wretches, the world waxed dark before my face, and my soul knew not in what place it was. But my wife humbly stood up, weeping before, and wheedling the slave, and saying, "O my beloved, and very fruit of my heart, there is none left to cheer me but thy dear self. And if thou cast me off, who shall take me in, O my beloved, O light of my eyes?" She ceased not weeping and abasing herself to him until he deigned to reconcile. Then was she right glad and said, "O my master, what hast thou here for thy handmaiden to eat?" "Uncover the basin," he grumbled, "and thou shalt find at the bottom the broiled bones of some rats we dined on. Pick at them, and then go to that slop pot where thou shalt find some leavings of beer, which thou mayest drink. So she ate and drank, and washed her hand, and went and lay down by the side of the slave upon the cane trash, and stripping herself stark naked, she crept in with him under his foul coverlet and his rags and tatters. When I saw my wife, my cousin, the daughter of my uncle, do this deed, I clean lost my wits, and climbing down from the roof, I entered and took the sword which she had with her, and drew it, determined to cut down the twain. I first struck the slave's neck, and thought that the death decree had fallen on him. And Shahrazad perceived the dawn of day, and ceased to say her permitted say. The seventh night had a super dramatic ending. I hope you can sleep with all the action going on, but let's not think about the bloody violence at the end, but instead think about the fact that although this prince is so beautiful apparently and so honorable, his wife not only loathes him, but she is in love with a poor black man who is living on the outskirts of the city in slums. It's true that love knows no boundary, recognize race or social level. It is a sad and violent story, but it's also about love, so maybe think about that. Good night.